Get the knives out. Dish is about to be served. Outrageous. Are you kidding? I've been inside only one woman after I was born. The Statue of Liberty. Provocative. If it's a pain in the ass, honey, you're not doing it right. Pop culture. Meanwhile, she's on the cover of Us Weekly, dating. Boyfriends are like jobs, except he probably stopped sucking after a year. Wicked. What do I look for in a guy? My dick. Smart. Sassy. Contemporary. I mean, I can't. Porn Again, the podcast.
Hey, everyone. It's Josh Sabara having a bad hair day. I know, look at that. Thank goodness for the top of the earphones. But whatever. We're here to listen, not to look, in my opinion. Welcome to Porn Again, the podcast. My guest today is the talented Mr. Luke Baines, now starring in the final film that horror master Wes Craven produced, The Girl in the Photographs, which is in theaters nationwide and on demand. Is that right?
That is correct.
And it sort of tells the story of two psychos who target a group of models at a like secluded house. So it's very uplifting.
Super uplifting. There's definitely some morals in there as well.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. Before we get into the movie and a little bit about your background, I usually go over a few topics that are happening in the media that are annoying to me that that day or week.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, you know, that's sort of me in a nutshell. So every time I'm looking at gossip sites now, I keep finding pictures of Justin Bieber naked. So, for example, he was away in Bora Bora and there were these paparazzi shots or somebody shot photos of right. him. And, you know, you saw the full Justin, apparently. And it was like a big Twitter thing. And Bette Midler commented on it on the whole thing on she was commenting on it and he didn't know who Bette Midler was. And it was a whole back and forth. Then recently over Easter, he posted a picture on Instagram of him standing there from behind, but totally naked. Mm-hmm. So there was a big moon in the shot. So, and his caption on that thing was "dat ass doe," D-O-E, as in though. So "dat ass doe."
Yeah.
Now that's all lost on me because I'm 41.
Right.
You're much younger than I am.
Right.
So I assume that's a language you speak.
Yes. Okay. Yes, obviously.
What is that? Like, why does he feel the need to, why do we need to see him? I mean, I don't want to see him, period, let alone with his clothes off. And, you know, I like to see any guy with his clothes off.
I don't know. I have used the phrase "that ass though." That ass though.
Apply to yourself?
But never to myself.
Okay.
No.
I mean, I think if somebody's saying that about you, that's lovely. But for you to recognize your own ass dough.
Yeah, nah. No, I would never do such a thing.
And can you say that for me again in how it's supposed to be said?
Well, I mean, look, I don't know because I'm not
No, but
American
it sounded pretty like, right on.
That ass dough.
See? I mean, what the fuck is that?
I don't know. It's definitely in that like realm of like that bae dough, you know?
Okay, and what is that? That bae dough?
That's like that bae. That's my bae. That's my baby, though.
So what is bae? Bae is the, but you just are leaving a letter out.
Yeah, we don't have time.
So how is it, is the one letter really, you know, makes things more efficient?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe. Okay. I have no idea.
I don't know what is happening to the language.
You gotta run with it. Otherwise, we get left behind, you know?
So do we think if he's so busy posting pictures himself without clothes on that those pictures that came from Bora Bora really were paparazzi snaps, or do we think that that could have been a staged leak, so to speak? I mean, it wasn't like he had anything to be embarrassed about. I saw the picture.
Yeah, you did. You're the former publicist. I don't know. I don't know how those things work. Like, I wouldn't think that his team would sit down and think that that was a good career move. Would you?
Well, I've not worked with anyone who's leaked nude photos or,
right.
but you know, the sex tape and the nude photo thing is a new thing. Phenomenon,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Kim Kardashian is a star because.
Well, why would he do it? It's not like it's making him any, he wasn't.
Well, maybe because we're talking about him.
It's a very good point.
I don't know. I can't with that. Okay. Here's the other issue I'm having this
Excellent.
Week. So
bring it on.
Last night was the Academy of Country Music Awards.
Mm-hmm.
and the iHeart Music Awards just last night.
Yeah.
Do we have too many award shows? I mean, how many more trophies can we give to the same fucking people?
And it is. It's all the same people over and over again.
Over and over and over.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it would be much better if it was a, you know, a breakthrough artist awards or something. It's one I just
because then
up.
You could be you just came I up with an award it. For yourself. Because that's then, clever.
No, because one of the things that bugs me about American radio is it's the same songs over and over and over and over again.
Right.
So we're going talking about music there. But in Australia we've got one radio station that's just dedicated solely to discovering new artists. And I love it. Where everyone like it's a really big radio station in Australia, because it's never the same stuff over and over again.
See, that's what we need. I mean, everybody here, we're all about, in LA, it's all about giving everybody awards. Like, during award season, the Academy Awards, the Friday before, the Publicist Guild has an award show. I'm like, leave it to the publicist to figure out a way to prize themselves.
Yeah, yeah. But even that, even the lead up, you've got the Globes, you've got the Screen Actors Guild Awards. Broadcast Critics, Oscars, the Spirit Awards.
Independent Spirit.
I'm sure there's a couple more.
There's more where I'm not thinking of because I try to block it all out now. But it's too much. Yeah. It's like too many awards.
We should probably stop patting ourselves on the back and just get on with it.
And also then you look at things like the Grammys and the Emmys, not to take away from anybody who has any of those awards, but there's a Grammy for everything. Like there's a Grammy for Best Fart in the Morning. There's a Grammy for, you know, best spoken word by somebody whose last name starts with the letter R and was born in the month of September.
Right.
I mean, there is literally a Grammy for everything.
Well, because I remember watching the Grammys and, like, I think it was, like, Kathy Griffin won a Grammy. I was like, I didn't know she was a singer.
And my comedian friend... for her, like, her audio book or something.
My comedian friend was like, no, it's, like, a thing. It's like
my audio book totally should have won a Grammy.
I believe
so. That was a performance.
You narrated it yourself?
I sure did. I think it's a little bit of a cheat to have a memoir. I don't have the best voice in the world, but I kind of feel like when I'm listening to a memoir, I want to hear... I want to hear the person telling his or her own story.
I want Anthony Hopkins narrating mine.
Do you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you have a great voice. You don't need that.
No, I want Anthony Hopkins or James Earl Jones.
Well, I think now with the idea that they're reminding them that they could possibly win Grammys for it, I think we might be able to make that happen. Anyway, it's just weird to me. And like the Emmys, the same thing. It's like best actress in a miniseries made for TV, but that may have aired on TV or may have aired in a movie, in a theater for don't know, give her an Emmy.
But that whole thing's ridiculous. Like they keep changing the goalposts on whether it's a whether it's a mini series or an actual series.
Right.
Or and it's a comedy or it's a drama.
Well, that's like the Golden Globes. Yeah. It's like they will shoehorn something into a category.
Yeah.
You know, like The Revenant is best comedy.
Right.
Best performance by a bear in a comedy.
It was a brilliant
bear. I mean,
he did an incredible job though.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it was a male. That was.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't check. I didn't see between the bear's legs. Okay, so most important now is The Girl in the Photographs, your new movie that opened recently and is available on demand right now as well.
Yeah.
So first I want to know a little bit about your background. I know you moved from Manchester to Australia when you were a toddler, basically. You were three, I think. And in a recent interview, you mentioned something about having an Australian accent but having English values.
Yes.
But you didn't go further than that. What does that mean?
That was something I said off the fly and didn't think it would go into print.
Right. And then here we are and you're being called on it.
Yeah. What I guess it's like I think that I take on more English values. Like I apologize to people when they bump into me in the street. Which is a very English thing to do.
That is true because one of my friends who lives in the UK comes here to visit and he doesn't expect service from anyone here. Like he's, you know, when somebody brings him something at a restaurant, like he's so grateful. And I'm like, but that's what you tip them for. Like that's her job.
Yeah.
And he's so grateful for it, which I guess we should all be.
Right.
But
yeah. I think that I'm very much that person, very much like, thank you. It's funny because one thing that I keep laughing about with my girlfriend is this thing that I've noticed in America. When you say thank you to someone rather than saying you're welcome, some Americans say, mm-hmm. And it bugs me to no end.
That they can't, that you can actually get two words out of your mouth and they can just get a little mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is that?
It's a little smug.
It's smug. Mm-hmm. It's like, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Or what about, do you find, like, I find that a lot of people here, like, I'll go somewhere and you hold a door or you...
Right.
You're in the theater and you stand up for somebody to get to his or her seat and they don't thank you.
Right. Yeah, I yell at those people.
I usually just say, you're welcome.
Yeah, that's what I do. Quite passive aggressive.
I mean, there have been a couple times where I have actually pulled a door closed. Like somebody, like I literally will walk back and pull the door closed.
That's good.
Because, you know, why not? I figure if I can make one person cry a day, I've done my job.
That's a very good goal to
have. Right?
At least one.
And it's attainable.
For sure.
Like, you can't not succeed at that, especially if you're me.
Meanwhile, it's like 11:55 and you're running around the streets of downtown LA trying to find someone to make cry.
I'm like, I haven't made anyone cry today. We're not done with this interview. okay, so you... So my next question for you is actually how you find living in LA, like the lifestyle and the people compared to what you're used to. And by the way, one thing to backtrack for a second. Mm. So you said, so the English values are, I don't know why that cracks me up. The English values are the, you know, very nice and deferential and thank you, thank you, thank you. So Australians don't have those values, but they have a cool accent. Is that?
Sure. No, I mean, like I think the reason I said that is because I grew up in an English household. So while okay. I grew up in Australia, I do, there are just things I identify with more from an English perspective in terms of English chocolate. I miss it all the time.
Like trifle, Cadbury.
Yeah, Cadbury chocolate, trifle, shepherd's pie. These are things that my mum cooked.
Minstrels.
Minstrels.
I like to call them menstrels.
Of course you do.
Right.
Of course you do.
As a gay guy would.
Mm-hmm. But then there's other things. Like I think... You know, and that kind of feeds into your next question. Because I lived in London for 5 years before I moved to LA. And Australians are very, very laid back. Like, mm-hmm. they're just a really laid back people. And it takes a lot to piss them off. It just takes a lot for anything, really. They're quite easygoing.
I won't be emigrating.
English are more standoffish in my experience. It takes a while, but once you have broken through, they're very, very loyal and they will be to a fault. Whereas in America, I find that, or at least in Los Angeles, it's a very LA thing because I don't know about the rest of the country. Well, I think it's a very LA thing, but they're your best friend as soon as you meet them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you turn around, there's a knife in your back. Right. And that's what I like.
I always say the only time you get a pat on the back in LA is when they're looking for a place to put the knife.
That's a good one. That's good. But
I think you're right. I think that people, you know, it's a very transient town. People yeah. come and go. Mm-hmm. They're coming here to make their fortune in a mm-hmm. business that, you know, changes like the wind.
Right.
And so they look to make friends quickly.
Right.
And to bond quickly. And there's that illusion of being closer sooner than you are and because of what you might be able to get for that person right. or get them, who you might be able to get them in front of.
That's it. That's always the first question. It's what are you doing? How can you help me? But I will preface what I said with, I have found that the people who've grown up in Los Angeles aren't like that. It's usually, like you said, the ones who have come in.
Who are here to be in that business.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Did you find that sort of culture shock?
I did because, you know, in my first month, I like had, you know, signed with a huge manager. I had, you know, done a bunch of management meetings, met a bunch of people. And if you had asked me, I would have been like, well, I've made it. Everything is right in front of me. I've been promised
right.
the world.
Right.
How can this
But you fall? Basically had because most this, people don't even
how can this fall
meet
apart?
The manager.
Right. But, you know, it did take a good couple of years to really figure out who actually has my back and who my real friends are. And finding that network was so important.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it was mostly Australians. I have
there branched
out since. I've got a couple of American friends.
I would think you'd throw a few English people in there just so they can
I've got
say
a
your thank yous.
Yeah.
And,
you well, know. You know, you've got to have something to bond over.
So how old were you when you actually started acting? And I'm also curious, like, did your family and your parents encourage it?
Yeah. I am the youngest of four children. I've got three older sisters. So I was very much babied by my mother. I did try and play rugby when I was four, and it didn't last very long. She saw me get tackled, and that was the end of that. But I do remember being around five or six and watching E.T. and saying to my mom, I could do that. I want to do that.
E.T. was my favorite movie.
To the little boy in it.
The sad part is that I saw it in the theater and you saw it on video.
Yeah.
It's true. But I went and I saw it. I think I saw it eight times in the theater.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm. I was obsessed. I had E.T. sheets, E.T. towels, E.T. the Pizza Hut glasses. You name it. If E.T. was on it, I had it. They even had a finger, a long E.T. finger that lit up at the end that, you know, I could have saved so much on sex toys as an adult.
For sure.
Had I hung on to that one. But
you always know where it is.
I had, exactly. There's a light, the light at the end,
there's
right?
The light at the end of the tunnel.
So, as it were. But I had everything. I mean, you name it. And to this day, I still have a life-size plush E.T. in my bedroom.
Excellent.
What does that say to you?
All right. What does it say to me? I think the therapist is on the left.
Yeah. But, Julianne's gone.
Julianne's gone.
Okay, so you saw E.T. So it was Henry Thomas that sort of... Mm-hmm. inspired you.
And and my mom thankfully put me in some acting classes. I mean, you know, acting classes when you're six aren't Stanislavski, but there's something,
right?
And
well, at least it's encouraging, and it's, you know, my parents, I talked about wanting to tap dance and do, you know, anything in the arts, and they sort of pushed that away. Okay. I mean, this is all in my book, but you know, they basically felt that it was something that at that time I would have been made fun of for.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they saw that as a activity that my sister would be doing and not an activity that I would be doing. So I felt like I could have been starring in The Girl in the Photograph.
Potentially tapping your way through it.
Right. But I mean,
it's interesting though that like that they were trying to, you know, protect you, but in a way actually like hurting you.
But you know, at that time, you know, their attitudes were commensurate with the sort of political climate. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, you know, the thing that was a concern to them then. I think now it would be a non-issue, but I always wanted to do those things. Like they would take us to the theater in New York and I'd be like, I want to do that. You know, I have zero talent, just so you know, like I can't sing, I can't dance. I have no coordination. It wouldn't have worked out.
Right. You never know. I could have been a rugby player. You could have been a tap dancer.
There you go.
But yeah, did that, did the lessons and then did that for a few years. I kind of, when I was 14, went to an acting conservatory in Australia and started to get serious about it. And that was unlike anything. That it's still one of the best times of my life. It was, you know, singing, dancing, drama, everything, and the only people who went there were performers, so it was like fame.
But what was the process to get into? I mean, did you have to audition to get in there?
Yeah, you auditioned, and it was a selective. It's the best for what it is. It's the best one in Australia, and yeah, you audition and get in, and it was to an hour and a half away from my school, so I'd have to catch the train an hour and a half there, an hour and a half back, which was long. It was like, I'd leave at 7 a.m., get home at 7 p.m. every day.
So that was in addition to, that wasn't part of your regular curriculum. That was in addition to.
That was everything. That was 5 days a week. So that was my high school and performing arts. So it was a performing arts school.
And then what about the modeling part? Because I know you had a modeling career as well. When does that come in?
That was more recent. So that happened until I was 17, and then I decided that I didn't want to be a struggling actor. Just wasn't at all in what I wanted out of life. So I went to university. I did a business degree, like a Bachelor of Business, and I did it in 2 years, so I didn't have to fuck around. I was like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it real quick and then get the hell out.
So you're a smarty pants.
So I did that. just read a lot. And I did that and then moved to London and got an office job for a bit because I decided that that was also what adults do. Realized after a very short time that I didn't like it. Met a casting director at a party and she was like, come audition for me. So I did. And she ended up getting me an agent. was in the UK doing that for a bit, and then I came out to LA. And so I started modeling a little bit in London, and then I started modeling when I came out to LA. The modeling thing was fun. I mean, it's also like terrible. It's just absolutely messed up. Like, I remember going to a casting and this French woman was like looking through, and I'm not going to do the accent because I can't do it, but she was like looking through my book and she was like, oh, I like, he's ugly. Ugh. No, I don't like that. Maybe I do. Is it interesting? No, it's not. Thank you.
That is, I would not, that is too much rejection.
Yeah. Oh, and I could, it was not. Like, you know, three a day.
And how do you deal with that? Because there's so many more no's in this business mm-hmm. than there are yeses. Mm-hmm. So it's constant rejection.
Constant.
I mean, yeah. That's your job is rejection. It's absolutely. Your professional reject.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for pointing that out. you know, it's hard. It is really, really hard. And it gets slightly easier, but at least for me, it hasn't. I haven't gotten to a point where I'm like, oh, well, for me to when I audition for something, I invest in that project because otherwise it's not going to be any good.
Right.
You've got to invest into it. You've got to do the research. You've got to, you know, go through the process. And anytime you invest in something and it doesn't happen, you have expectations and they're not met. It's sad. And I think the part of the learning process is differentiating between, oh, I'm not talented, that's why I didn't get this. And it's actually because I've got a thin upper lip and that offended one of the producers, which is a real thing.
Right.
I sat in on a casting session once and they were like, oh, we can't hire her. And I was like, why? She was really brilliant. He's like, can't concentrate on what she's saying. Her lips are too thin.
It's so funny that you say that because I think so many people don't realize that it can come down to something mm-hmm. so small.
So, so small. And even now it's a whole other beast as well in terms of social media. You know, there are so many projects that if you don't have over 200,000 Twitter followers, you're mm-hmm. not even going to get in the room.
Well, that happens in publishing now too.
I can imagine.
I heard a book agent recently mention something that he was shopping a book and that a certain publisher, I don't remember which one it was interested in people who had a certain number of followers mm-hmm. and who had a certain platform on YouTube.
Right.
So never mind. Now, I get that. It's commerce. Like, right. You want to sell books, but mm-hmm. what happened to being a great writer and nurturing an artist right. and getting them out there?
And that's I think, something that's really interesting and will probably be a telltale sign of our industry, you know, to see where it will go. And I understand it as well. You know, I've written a couple of scripts, one of which was picked up by a production company. So I was in the process of developing mm-hmm. it with them. And it matters what actors you have. Each actor has a pre-sale figure on their head. So, you know, if I have actor A, it means that in Germany I can get $2 million worth of pre-sales, which means I can get so much money to go towards the making of this film. Like, I get all of that. It's just sad when it comes down to when the focus is on the money and not actually the talent.
Well, you notice now they're working in reverse and they're taking YouTube stars and putting them into movies. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the first ones, I think it's there's a YouTube personality named PewDiePie.
PewDiePie.
Yes, and PewDiePie will be starring in a feature that I don't know if it will air on YouTube. I don't remember where it airs. Mm. But so now they're working in reverse and they're taking people who have those followings. Instead of taking somebody and building a following for that person, they're taking people with the following who may or may not really be mm-hmm. an actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know.
He might be brilliant. Yeah.
He may be great. But, yeah. I mean, chances are all of these YouTube people are not fantastic performers.
Right.
So, you know, and even with these books, you know, what happens is people go to Barnes & Noble. They line up. There'll be thousands of people. Mm-hmm. The quote, writers mm-hmm. / YouTube stars will go in the day before and pre-sign the books because the people who are in line, they don't want a book. They want their picture with that person.
Right.
So they're basically using the book as an entry ticket. Mm-hmm. So it looks like a publishing success, but really I'm
so
confused by it. Okay, so before, let's back up from modeling for a minute. So you were on a Australian soap opera called Home and Away, which sort of started the careers of a number of people. Like, am I wrong?
No, you're not.
If I am wrong, don't tell me because I have a reputation.
No, I was very briefly on that show for Blink and You'll Miss It.
Okay.
And it's funny because that like, I wouldn't have even mentioned it in terms of, like, my life. I forget about it. And it's like one journalist has picked it up, one journalist has picked it up, one journalist has picked it up.
Well, then I'm not even going to continue to talk about it. Consider it over.
But hey, it's a great show and it has launched a number of Australian screens.
But we're not interested in them.
Sure.
So then you also had a, and this is something I want to get into with you. You also did the workshop for Spring Awakening with Duncan Sheik and Steven Sater. Is that right?
Yeah.
And that was for the LA production of?
No, it was for the West End production in London.
But then you wound up doing the
up doing an LA version of it, but not with Duncan or Steven. So when I was doing my office job, met a casting director and she was like, what do you do? And I was like, I work in corporate communications. She was like, you're an actor. I was like, no, I'm not actually. And she's like, come audition for me. It'll be fun. And I did and ended up auditioning for it and doing the workshop for 6 months, you know, taking so many dentist appointments. It was it was ridiculous.
I can't tell you how many cavities and root canals I've had in my career.
So many root canals. did that and that's kind of how that was the gateway to get me back into performing. But did that and it was an incredible experience. I did the workshop, the play got transferred to the West End and I didn't go with it. They brought in another guy a week before the transfer and gave it to him, which was...
Ooh, that's very like Patti LuPone, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Sunset Boulevard-y.
It was torturous.
That is theater drama.
But it was...
Were you like devastated by that?
Oh, like you wouldn't imagine. Because and also I had put everything on this. I was like, if this doesn't work out, then I'm not doing it. You know, like I'm not going to be an actor if this doesn't work out. This is the one. I'll give it this one. Idiot. Of course I was going to do it always. But anyway, and it was amazing though because I got what I needed. Looking back on it, I got what I needed out of it. I got the answer that I needed to be doing this and that I wanted to be doing this. And, you know, I got an agent out of it and I also learned a very valuable lesson in terms of that was really interesting for me because I had worked on it for so long, and put so much pressure on it. I took the character from somewhere where I started off, where they loved it, where it was really interesting and funny. And I went way too dark and internal with him to a point where it kind of wasn't funny at all anymore. It was just sad. So,
but didn't they direct you otherwise?
They gave me, I remember hearing direction, but rather than hearing what they were telling me, I was hearing something else. And, I was really young. So it was, such a great lesson. And, you know, it's one that is really helpful now because now I get direction and if I don't know what it is, I will ask. As opposed to back then, I'd be like, oh, don't ask. It looks like you're stupid. Just do something.
Well, I, for one, am not a fan of Spring Awakening.
Why not?
I don't get it. First of all, as a gay guy, I love a good musical. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're starting off at 100.
Exactly.
Then the subject is sex.
Right. Gotta love that.
This is out of the park as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And Duncan Sheik, whom I love.
Brilliant.
So to me, it sounds like a perfect recipe. Mm-hmm. It's like a big cake with chocolate icing on it, right? And then I go into the theater and could barely keep my eyes open because I was like, this is so boring to me. Right. And there isn't one piece of music that I remember. Like, it didn't resonate with me at all. So I leave, this was in previews on Broadway. Right. I leave the theater and I think to myself, you know, it wins the Tony, whatever it won. And I think to myself, what? I'm missing something. Mm. Like, what is it that I'm not seeing in this piece of material? So when it was in LA, I was like, I'm going to go back and show myself that I was wrong. I barely made it to intermission. So I'm like, I just do not respond to this material for whatever reason. Obviously, I'm in the minority.
Right. It's so interesting.
I don't know what... So what is it that you see in that material?
That was the first musical that felt life-changing for me. Like, I just... It's my... Definitely my top two favorite musicals.
What's the other?
Rent.
Okay, I can go with Rent. Yeah. I was a big Rent fan when it first opened. It's a little dated now, but
But I think that maybe I don't know. I mean, I saw Spring Awakening when I was a teenager, so maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know. Like feeling that teen angst. I just think it's so beautifully written. The music is so good.
See, I don't know. And they just revived it in New York. Did you see that?
I didn't.
The Deaf West production.
No, it started out here.
Oh, so they had some, but they also did, they also brought it to Broadway. And my ex-friend Cameron Manheim was in it with Marley Matlin.
Okay.
And I remember thinking to myself, Marley Matlin is the luckiest bitch in that show because she doesn't fucking have to hear it 8 times a week. Anyway.
Oh, Josh.
So let's get back to the girl in the photograph,
okay,
shall we?
Nice segue.
So you could not be creepier in that movie.
Thanks.
So what went into landing that job?
I auditioned for it like everyone else. When I was going into the audition, and this is the reason that I booked it, there were a bunch of guys around me who looked much more like the role had been described.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's described as, like he was shirtless and muscular and very handsome. And I was like looking at these guys and thinking, okay, I'd cast them. They're much more suited for the role. They had that like real, like masculine, I'm going to murder you energy.
But you had a shirtless scene and you looked great.
Yeah, I had to put on like 20 pounds for that. But because I'm naturally like female ballerina, but not because
you did look good. You
just
looked
slim,
yeah. But you looked great in the movie.
Yeah, well, it took a lot of chicken to do that. A lot of chicken.
I tend to go for Snickers, but you know, whatever. Different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, exactly. But I was watching them, and they were all so intense, and rather than feeling, I don't know, like I was going to try and match that. I was like, I'm not that. And also I don't agree with that. I think it's a very like one-dimensional view of a murderer, because most murderers, you wouldn't have a freaking clue who they are. They're the guy who served you coffee this morning.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, well, anyway, so I went in there and just played him kind of very polite and endearing. And, you know, from my perspective, he was very much in love with this girl who he is stalking. You know, which from the outside looks terrible, but he really likes her. And so I kind of just played it like I was hitting on a girl.
Yeah, that's probably what made it so creepy, is that you sort of played it as though it wasn't, like you said, like you weren't, you know, a stalker or murderer, but just as you were sort of somebody who was looking to catch a girl's eye.
Yeah, kind of sweet is how I played it. And they responded really well. And to, you know, like, honestly, to so much credit to the filmmakers, because it's not a conventional choice by any means. And they had conventional, they had, you know, really big actors who were going up for that role, who have, you know, Twitter following, who have a resume longer than my arm, you know, who are not household, but quite well-known, you know, actors. And they went with me because they believed in what I did. And
but now that I've seen the movie, I can't picture somebody else. I mean, I so picture you. It's
right.
Like so, it was so spot on to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of the sign that something works, when you've seen something and then you can't picture somebody else doing it.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose if I didn't know better, I wouldn't know.
Right.
But now that I've seen that, it seems like a perfect choice.
Well, I think that's kind of what Nick, our director, said when he saw me. He was like, everyone else that came in, I was like, no, we've already found him. And they kept parading more and more guys because, you know, there were certain people who wanted bigger names because it meant more money and whatever else. And maybe the film would be, you know, the number one in the box office this weekend if it had been someone else. But
or maybe it wouldn't have done as well as it did because people wouldn't have responded to the killer so much.
And maybe that.
George. Maybe. I mean.
but no.
Because you know what an optimist I am.
I know. Yeah, I know.
I'm always looking on the bright side.
It's just when you think you're going to zig zag. but, you know, and thankfully we had Wes Craven attached to it, who was a real champion for everyone who was in that film, because most of the actors are relatively unknown. And he really got behind all of us and pushed and pushed and pushed so that we could all have those roles.
And did you, how closely did you work with him?
He was going through treatment at the time.
Yeah, I know he was ill.
He was ill.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stuff, I didn't meet him until the table read, until I'd already been cast. He was watching all of our audition tapes and he was working very closely with Nick. So I met him at our first table read, which I happened to be late to, which was fantastic. I was the
great
only one.
Great impression.
Great first impression. The only one not there. Walked in, everyone was sat down, scanned the room, saw Wes Craven, shat my pants. And,
but I think that's good. The killer should keep people at a guarded distance.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
should be that waiting
was,
for you.
It was actually, it was a convention.
It was a choice.
It was a choice. It was a choice, yeah. But he was so lovely. He was not at all what you would expect from someone who does horror films. He was so sweet and not Hollywood at all. Looked at you in the eye when you talked to him. Made you feel as though, you know, you both had all the time in the world. And he was so sweet and he was really, you know, this film wouldn't have happened without him. He was a mentor to Nick Simon through the Writers Guild of America, and that's how the film came about. He had read the script and was like, I want to help you make this. I think it's a brilliant script. And he'd said to us during the table read that the reason he wanted to do this script, he was like, it's the first script that I've seen that's reminded me of the first Scream movie. It's so tight. It's so together. You know, you've got one of the best cinematographers in the industry, which is Dean Cundey, who shot
Halloween, right?
Halloween 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. Jurassic Park 1, 2, and 3. Back to the Future 1, 2, and 3. He loves this, obviously, a trilogy.
Yeah.
Death Becomes Her.
Things book. Work. Who doesn't love
who
Death
framed,
Becomes Her?
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Mm-hmm. I mean, the list goes on.
So you were in good hands.
Really good hands. And that's what he said. He was like, you know, you never know what's going to happen, but you've got an incredible cast, you've got an incredible director, you've got an incredible script, you've got an incredible cinematographer. He was like, you're so far ahead of everyone else. He couldn't come up to, we shot in Victoria in Canada and he couldn't come to
which
set.
Which is beautiful. How best. Great is it's, Victoria?
I love it.
When I worked for New Line, we used to shoot a ton of films in Vancouver and in that area. Yeah. We would sometimes take a day trip to Victoria. Ugh, so
we,
nice.
We all want to move there, but, I mean.
And people are so nice there.
So sweet. Yeah. He was watching dailies every day, giving us feedback and saw everything, through the final cut. Which is nice.
And so what did you do specifically to prepare for this role? Because I understand you went through a process talking to...
Yeah, so Nick and I, the director and I worked together to kind of create Tom as you see him. But I found a criminal psychologist at John Jay College who he's a professor, but he also works with the FBI and interviewed him and got some incredible stuff out of him about serial killers. And I read a ton of books about it that he had, you know, forwarded to me and some journal articles from other professors and psychologists. The biggest thing for me that was like the turning point in my research and the development of him was that this doctor told me that he was likely born that way, much in the same way that a pedophile has a predilection to children, my character has a predilection to violence against women. And there are a lot of people out there who feel this way and are able to, you know, satisfy those urges with snuff films or fantasy or whatever else. My character also has a lack of empathy because he's a sociopath and he's able to actually act out on it. Mm-hmm. But when he told me that idea that this guy was born with this affliction, or they call it a sexual abnormality, it made me feel for him in a different way. It wasn't so black and white. It was actually kind of sad that he's actually going through this. And which I think it's probably hard for people to understand that, but it made sense to me in that time.
Well, I think it's important as the actor probably to think all of that through.
It's also important, I think, for an actor to be able to love the character you're playing. It's so... I've never been in a situation where, and I've played some really messed up, I've played a guy who rapes his sister, I tend to play the darker roles. And I don't think I'll ever be able to play a character that I don't like. Like, I have to find a way to like this person because I just don't think it works otherwise. You know, I don't...
Like the person or like playing the person?
No, to be able to like him, empathize with him, put yourself in his mind. Not obviously. I'm not a serial killer, and I don't agree with what he does. But just want to point that one out.
We can't be friends anymore.
You know what's really funny is that I'm like, after watching How to Make a Murderer, which I hope you watch.
Yes, she's amazing.
Ugh, it's
oh wait, How to Make a Murderer. Sorry, I'm thinking How to Get Away with
Murder. Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
How to Make a Murderer. Yes, I have very distinct opinions on Making a Murderer.
Making a Murderer. Mm-hmm. That's what I was talking about. Now I'm like kind of a little bit scared about, you know, being falsely accused of a crime. Because
you don't really think he didn't do it, do you?
I think that he potentially might have done it, yes. But I... Going back to what I was, because that's a whole podcast, that one.
Right. Well, we can have Nancy Grace call in for that because she sat there with me on the phone and went through with me 10 things that, like, after she went through them with me, I was like, after, like, the third one, I was like, okay, never mind, you can stop. I get it. So and then by the 10th one, I was like, just keep him in jail.
What do I need to do to get that information from Nancy Grace?
We'll just have her call.
Okay. Done.
She'll be happy to. She'd be happy to talk to you. Actually, they did an amazing article with her in The Hollywood Reporter. Mm. If you look it up, they did a full transcript Q&A of why she thinks that he, you know, and he had been on the show, her show, and she had been following that story long before anybody even knew about it when it was just a missing persons case.
Interesting.
Not to say just as though that's worthless, but it was a missing person's case and nobody knew what had happened to her. So Nancy was on it and had interviewed him at that time and was suspicious of it at that time.
Interesting.
So when you read this article in The Hollywood Reporter, it's really fascinating to hear how, how much evidence there actually is. So, and I feel like the documentary, in my opinion... Mm-hmm. Should have been researched a little better.
And Nancy's a former prosecutor, right?
Correct.
Now,
never lost a case.
Does she think that he deserves to be in prison based on the evidence that was presented at trial?
I can't speak for that because I don't know. I don't know what her answer to that is.
Because that's what I find interesting is that whether or not I think he's innocent or not, I do not 100% believe that he should be in prison.
Based on the trial, based on what I saw. Well, we'll ask her.
But what I was going to say was, going back to I'm not a serial killer, is that, like, I'm genuinely scared of being falsely accused and being on a stand and them showing scenes from this movie and being like, well,
we've got footage.
There it is.
He does creepy way too well. What was it like when you'd finish, like, you're in the head of this person who's clearly off? Mm. Did you take that back to your hotel room or were you able to sort of shake it off at the end of
shooting? Sometimes. No, it's kind of like a hangover, you know, like it kind of stays with you. I remember I shot a film before this where I was playing like this rebellious teenager and I left set and was like going home and some guy cut me off on the 101 and I had a full can of soda. And I wound down my window and went to throw it at his windshield. Thank God remembered that.
Which so does not seem like you.
It's not me at all. But I literally was like, wait, what? And it's you know, I'd been in that skin all day of like, you know, being this like, you know, angsty teenager. So there were definite things in this film, but it was more... just like an icky feeling kind of, you know, that was one of the things that I wasn't prepared for in terms of like being on set and having these girls screaming and crying in cages or, you know, pulling them out of cars and feeling terrible, just feeling so horrible, even though you know it's not real and they're acting as well. It feels horrible to be, you know, tormenting someone in that way.
Right.
And there was one scene where we like pull this girl out of a car and we had to pull this stunt girl out and she falls on the concrete and you know, really hurt herself and she was really bleeding. And I was like trying to help her and my director's like, well, what are you doing? You're ruining this. Like, you're the killer. Can you try and look like you're enjoying it? And she was fine. She was like, oh, I do this every day. I love this. And I'm like...
Yeah, I saw that part where she's like crawling then along on the cement and I was thinking how much that must have hurt.
That was really hurt. Like, and then my buddy brings her back, throws her on the ground and she like smacks her head and that's her head hitting the concrete.
And then you photograph her.
And then I photograph her. Meanwhile, I was like, are you okay? What do you need? Trying to like help her. And she's like, I'm fine. This is what I do.
Right.
Sorry.
She's like, thanks, actor.
Yeah, right. Meanwhile, I like, I'm like, everyone's like, you know, I'm like, I just need 5 minutes. It's been a very traumatic day. I just need to go and take some time. Yeah.
So you, in the movie, you have an accomplice mm-hmm. who doesn't really speak.
Yes.
And his name is Jerry and your name is Tom. So you're Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
So what I was curious about, is that a nod to the cartoon? Is that like, was I missing something? What?
I don't know. You know, I never got an answer out of the director on that one.
Oh, so it was acknowledged.
It was acknowledged. I asked him. He did give me an answer and I can't quite remember what it was. But
it'd be like Chip and Dale. Or...
Yeah, it was just, I think it was just something that they put in the script as a joke. Mm-hmm. Just to have a name, and then it never got taken out mm-hmm. because he doesn't actually. I never refer to him as Jerry. The only reason you know his name's Jerry is because of IMDb, I think, or because of the credits. You know, it's not actually in there. I never say Jerry. You know, my name's Tom because I say it a couple of times,
right?
But otherwise, you wouldn't have ever known that. So I don't think that they had. It wasn't. I don't.
I guess
think
I paid
was,
too much attention.
You do. Yes. Yeah. Based on some of the other questions that you had before this,
but
yes,
they were legitimate questions.
They were legitimate questions.
And indicative of my enjoyment of the movie because I paid attention.
Right. And it's definitely one of those things that if I ever need a second opinion on a film, I'm probably going to send it your way because I know that you know everything that's going on in it.
Yeah, I'm pretty aware of it. I don't know all the dialogue, but I'm pretty familiar with the entire thing.
And if this doesn't work out, you could definitely do a continuity job. Of some kind on set. I think you'd be great at that.
So basically, you've now sort of joined the likes of like Freddy Krueger, Mike Myers, Leatherface.
Yeah.
What else do we have?
The Scream Boys, Skeet Ulrich.
Yeah. So how does that feel? Like you're sort of in that group. Is that a secret dream to join that club?
Absolutely.
I mean,
it doesn't even feel, it doesn't feel real, to be honest. Like it doesn't. I mean, I have, you know, 100 ways that I could discount that. But it is, it's exciting. You know, I always wanted to work with Wes Craven. And it still doesn't feel real that I actually got to, you know, like, and on the last thing that he did, I can't believe that that had happened. But, you know, I saw Scream when I was like 11 or 12 and way too young to be watching Scream. But watched Scream and just loved it and stole my dad's handy cam and made my like girlfriend, like, you know, my high school girlfriend at the time reenact scenes out of it where I remember having an egg beater and I had the Scream mask and the thing and I was like chasing her saying I was going to beat her to death. I thought it was really funny.
Wouldn't try that with a girlfriend now.
No. That's how I end up on the stand.
Yeah.
But and Scream still is in my top 10 films. I just love that movie. I think it's so brilliant and funny and scary.
Well, I feel like it's sort of what brought the horror genre back. I felt like there was like a period of time where those movies weren't
as
available. Mm-hmm. And now, once that happened, I sort of think that sort of marked, and maybe that's just in my head, but in my mind, it sort of marked a resurgence of the genre.
It definitely did.
To some degree.
It definitely did. And I think that... I think that was one of the things that Wes was so good at, was taking something that was known and proven and tipping it on its head and doing something else.
Okay, so if there was a showdown between Tom and Freddy Krueger, who would win?
I mean, look, I want to say Freddy because it's Freddy and he's very... But Tom's pretty smart.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, if there would be a... You know, if you'd be able to use your... The mind to
outdo the fingers. I'm going to say Freddy because he's just quite a... I mean, do I have Jerry with me?
You in this scenario, you can have Jerry.
Oh, I reckon I'd give him a good run for his money.
Okay, what about Michael Myers? See, because I think Michael Myers, like, duh.
No,
I mean,
Michael Myers, yeah.
He's sitting there in a white mask with a knife and he just kind of appears places. I think you could figure that out.
No, I think I can figure Michael Myers.
But Leatherface, I don't know. What about the chainsaw?
Yeah, look, I don't know. He's a big guy as well. Mm-hmm. Again, do I have Jerry? I need my muscle.
Okay, let's pit you and Jason Voorhees against each other in the middle of Camp Crystal Lake with no Jerry.
No.
You and Jason.
There's no way. Like, I reckon 15 seconds flat.
That Jason, you'd be done.
I'd be dead.
Okay.
I'm gone.
All right.
I'm gone, girl.
Now, what are you working on at the moment? What's
I am doing the rounds. I'm doing the old auditions, trying to get another job, which is lots of fun.
Yeah, but this movie sort of has been it was the talk of the Toronto Film Festival at the time,
and it's been actually really great. It's been a completely different experience now, having this behind me and going into rooms and getting into rooms I've never been in before, mm-hmm. Which is really, really nice, and getting some. really good traction and whatnot. So it's I've just at the start of the year signed with some new management team and just trying to find the right project to do next. I don't really want to do anything close to what I've just done, just because I don't want to, you know, pigeonhole myself in that.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, if the project's good enough, I might do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what would be your dream role? Like, if you could create the next job for yourself, what would it be?
I'd love to be like a villain in the James Bond movie, which is very similar to what I just played. I mean, that would be brilliant.
What would your name be?
Isn't it the? Oh no, that's my porn star. Oh my! What's the first street you lived on?
We could use that and your pet.
So my pet,
it's the name Paris, of your first pet, and then
yeah,
the street,
which is Paris Honey Eater.
Paris Honey Eater.
Yeah,
I mean that
Honey Eater place.
Yeah. It doesn't get better than
doesn't,
that.
It's actually pretty. It's pretty great.
Paris Honey Eater.
Yeah, but no, something like that, or I mean, I would just. I think the dream role, honestly, is working opposite people that I admire. Like you mentioned, Cate Blanchett. I would happily give a limb to work with her. I just think she's so brilliant.
That Leo, would limit your roles after, though.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
There's not always a call for a limbless.
There's not, is there? No. But I have faith that the film would be so brilliant that I could get away with it.
And you know what? If that happens, when that happens, I'll contribute to the cost of your prosthetic for after,
that's
just
really
as
sweet.
A congratulatory
Thank
thing.
You. I really said appreciate it here. That.
Yeah.
You can even maybe like take a space that you can put your name on, like a little nameplate.
I'll literally give you a hand. okay, so The Girl in the Photographs is in theaters now and on VOD.
Yep.
And people can follow you at Luke Baines, LukeBaines on Twitter and Instagram. And now, so I always take the last couple minutes because we need to answer a sex and or dating question from my files at Gay Times Magazine and some of the dating stuff I do for the Huffington Post.
What is it?
So we have a letter from a man named David. Now, this is a letter from a man who's in a same-sex relationship, but the question really applies to any relationship, so you can weigh in however you see
fit. I was going
to
anyway.
Yeah. So David is in Phoenix, and he wrote because his partner 5 years recently admitted to sometimes fantasizing about famous men and certain of their friends during sex. And he wants to know if that's normal and if he should worry that his husband might act on those urges with some of their pals. His partner has never given him reason to believe that he's been unfaithful in the physical sense, but now David feels undesirable. So curious as to what your take on that is first before I weigh in.
I think, obviously, I have, it's like a blind leading the blind, but I think the fact that he was honest about it, I think is a really good sign. It's not like he's hiding this secret desire for their friends or for, you know, I think a famous thing is fine. I don't know anyone who's not fantasizing about a famous person. And also,
I think it's the friend. If you're going to be troubled by part of
friends.
It, it's probably the
it's
friend
the
part.
Yeah. And I think the fact that he's being honest about it counts for a lot.
I think communication is the key to, basically the key to a good relationship and good sex.
Yeah.
I mean, sex is probably 80% communication.
Agreed.
Is what I always say. In my opinion, I think it's totally normal to fantasize. I think if you are not seeing a celebrity that you find attractive or even seeing somebody on the street or having had a thought about a friend, you're probably not human because we all look at everybody and we think, oh, what would it be like to have sex with this one? Or what would it be like to have sex with that one? So I think that's completely normal. And I don't think it makes the other partner undesirable. It's just a matter of being a person who's wired to be a sexual human being.
Right.
And I think if the partner, which he says, has never given him a reason to feel like he would physically step out on the relationship, then there's really nothing to worry about. And here or there, you know,
I think it's also
let him yell out someone else's name.
Right. It's also it's human nature to want the things that we don't have.
I agree. And if you're in a good relationship and, you know, his partner's being totally honest with him. And I don't think it's a strange thing to begin with. So no. I say that David, you know, you can let him know. I think David should let him know how he feels and let him know that sometimes it makes him feel undesirable and let his partner reassure him a little bit. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's really anything fatal happening.
No. And I also think that, like, that whole attraction thing, there's so many other things that, like, if you're fantasizing about a friend or a celebrity, it's image based. It's all, it's not because, you know, you're fantasizing about having, you know, some sort of passionate connection with, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a superficial thing. And, you know, being in a relationship with someone is so much more about, you know, what's under the surface. Exactly. I wouldn't be worried.
There you go. All right. Well, Luke Baines, thank you for being here. Everybody go see The Girl in the Photographs and check us out for some new episodes coming soon at We Play Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. The No Holds Barred conversation continues 24/7 on Facebook at Josh Sabara Author and Twitter and Instagram at Josh Sabara. And then buckle your seatbelts for some titillating real talk. Porn Again, a memoir by Josh Sabara, is available now as a trade paperback, ebook, and audiobook.